What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends with John Krofcik and Larry Rifkin. We're always here trying to navigate through the waters of what the future looks like. And sometimes it's a little murky going through those waters, John.
The waters off Long Island here get pretty murky.
They do, and we are near Long Island Sound. But, the sound that you're going to hear in a moment is a topic that you probably have never thought about. And, John, I think when I brought this topic to you in one of those high-level editorial meetings we have.
Oh, yes.
And we usually have them on the fifth story of a four-story building that we can kind of rise above and see the sky because we're looking ahead
the horizon.
And beyond the horizon.
Yes,
right.
Absolutely.
So we have it up on the roof is what I'm trying to say. But this trend really kind of shocked me, and I had to think about it for a while and figure out whether this was something I thought our listeners would enjoy. But when you think about the new economy, that's a bit more difficult to measure because the value of many companies really is hard to discern. So you hear that Facebook bought WhatsApp for $2 billion.
Right.
And you say, first of all, WhatsApp?
That's
or
what
what's
say.
Up?
What's
or what is that? And how does it have a value of $2 billion when I've never heard of it?
Right.
Right?
You're buying intellectual property.
Intellectual property.
Yes.
Well, let's just be like the Chinese and steal it. Why do we have to buy into it?
There you go.
I don't get that. But in the old days, let's see. General Motors had, let me write this down, they had 20 factories, they had this amount of equipment, they had this much in sales,
right.
They had systems that could be sold off if necessary,
right.
So its market cap was X.
Right, they had machinery, they
right.
had workers, yes.
So if everything went wrong,
yes.
you still had some value there that was already plunked down and you could extract it in some way. But we have arrived in the 21st century. And John, for the first time, we began to invest more in intangible assets like design, branding, R&D, software, than buildings, machines, and hardware. Now, is that something you would have imagined?
No, you know, and now that you think about it, it's very, very true, but you know, I never imagined that at all.
Well, think about it. Facebook.
Yeah.
Now, Facebook paid that multiple for WhatsApp.
Right.
But by the way, what is Facebook worth and why? Can we figure that out?
Yeah, that's a good question, too.
Well, not only that, but you think about Uber, and they're a taxi service with no cabs. So if they had to sell the whole thing, they're really selling that application, that software. And software used to never be included when you counted what the value of an asset was in terms of a company. But now it's a big and bigger part than ever before.
At least with Uber and Lyft, they've figured out how to make it your ride more pleasurable than the way we were doing it with taxi cabs and buses in the past. So they at least provide a service where, like, WhatsApp and Facebook, what do they provide?
But in the same sense, John, I mean, if you and I wanted to start our own and we get a good ride-sharing service, we enlist guys and gals to be our drivers, and we do the same thing. So why do I need to go to Uber other than the branding or the software that they've already built that already allows us to do things that you and I would have to work really hard to develop and replicate?
Right. You know, that's right. The software and how they figure that out is what the value
exactly
is.
So that's so different
that
than
is.
The way we used to value companies, and this is now a larger part of the economy than ever before, and it's larger than the tangible assets piece just in the recent period. So this is a relatively new development. This is truly one of the great trends, unseen or explored, that has massive implications, until a couple of brainiacs from the UK set about to research it for the last decade. And they are Jonathan Haskell and Stian Westlake. And we got Stian to talk to us all the way over from across the pond. And I love that name, Stian. He joins us to discuss the findings from their new book, Capitalism Without Capital, The Rise of the Intangible Economy. And John, I bet this is going to be a first for many people who enjoy America Trends. They've never really thought about this.
I bet you it is.
And you'll find it only on America Trends. Thanks for coming by.
The book is called Capitalism Without Capital by Jonathan Haskell and Stian Westlake. And why don't you, Stian, lay out the basic premise for the book, because I think a lot of people looking at that title would say that sounds impossible.
So our new book, Capitalism Without Capital, argues that there's been a fundamental and long-term change in how the economy works. And specifically, that change is that once upon a time, most businesses invested in things that you could feel or touch: buildings, machines, vehicles, latterly computers. But now, for the most part, the majority of business investment is the things that you can't feel or touch, what economists call intangible assets, things like research and development, brands and marketing, organizational development, design, software, and data. We show in the book that there has been a sea change, that now most investment that businesses make takes that latter form, these intangible assets. We then argue that intangibles have different economic properties. And from there, we go on to say that this helps explain a bunch of puzzling phenomena in the economy today, from so-called secular stagnation and potentially slow productivity growth through inequality, through the challenges of financing the real economy.
We'll return to this episode of America Trends in just a moment. If you like what we're doing here at America Trends Podcast, please don't keep it to yourself. I know there are a lot of people, John, who think, well, if I'm listening and somebody else wants to listen at the same time, maybe we're going to collide and they're not going to be able to hear us.
Yeah.
Is that the way the technology works?
No, there's plenty of bandwidth. Everybody can listen at the same time.
All right. Well, that dispels that myth. Now, you can do a number of things that would really be helpful to us. You could give us a kind rating or a review at Apple Podcasts, and that boosts what they consider to be our value and visibility. And what does that do, John?
Well, that puts us in the forefront, so that you can find us easier, and most important is other people can find us easier.
And you can subscribe there or on our site, americatrendspodcast.com, or wherever you're listening, so we can alert you to new episodes of the podcast, which, by the way, we put out twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And stay in touch with us on both Facebook and Twitter at Trends Podcast. Or you can like us on Facebook or follow us where, John?
On Twitter.
On Twitter. That's right. Where the world turns to hear fake news or whatever it is. Well,
not
you can direct
we
message us at Trends Podcast or using hashtag Trends Podcast. And you know, John, with our growing audience, and really it's been pretty remarkable, a lot of people just came to us the last month or two and they might have missed earlier episodes. Can they get them again?
They can look through them and pick the ones they want to listen to. They're all on the website, and a lot of them are up on iTunes, many of them.
All right. Well, listen, there's lots of material to listen to. We hope you have the time, and we'll lend it to us because we try to make it worth your while. And thanks so much for listening.
And tell your friends.
We now return to this episode of America Trends.
How much have we caught up to this change in the way that we measure economic output?
There's a real shortfall in the way we measure economic output in a couple of ways. First of all, if we look at the headline figures that we see on the front page of newspapers, the GDP figures that measure how rich our countries are, those do not count most of these types of intangible investment as investment. So to some extent, they are undermeasuring how much we're investing and to some extent undermeasuring the size of the economy. Now, when you turn to company accounts, the balance sheets of corporations on which equity analysts make decisions about stock prices, they in some sense are even worse. because intangible assets, things like R&D, are even less well captured in company accounts. So you have this strange situation where some of the stuff is missing from the national accounts to determine GDP. And when it comes to individual corporations, equity analysts are forced very much to kind of make this up and come to conclusions themselves.
To make the intangible tangible in this conversation, let me ask you about a couple of examples. A lot of us are very confused when we see that Uber, perhaps the largest car company now in the world, has no cars, or we see that Airbnb, the largest hotel provider, has no rooms. We scratch our head and we say, how do you value a company like this or those companies?
Well, I guess the interesting thing about Uber and Airbnb is that although they don't have a lot of physical assets, a lot of tangible assets, you know, they maybe have a couple of office buildings and not much else, they have a lot of very valuable intangible assets. So if we think of Uber for a moment, Uber have extremely valuable software and algorithms that form the backbone of their business. They have a brand that's extremely well known and is extremely recognized and forms part of their part of their value. And another really important intangible is their networks. For a different business, you might call it their supply chain, but the strength of their driver partner network is a real source of competitive advantage. And if you see when Uber and Didi were fighting it out in China to dominate the market, a big part of what they were looking for, as well as the kind of brand loyalty and customer acquisition, was building those networks of drivers. And the fact that they spent a lot of money to try and time and effort to try and acquire those networks is a pretty strong sign that these are something valuable to have. And again, for us, a sign that if you don't treat these things as assets of some sort, then you're ignoring what makes companies like Uber and Airbnb valuable.
But then there are people who can get into this space more quickly because they don't have to gear up by buying an entire fleet of vehicles. If they can model, or dare I say, steal that kind of technology and then have a different spin on it and put their own sizzle on the steak, is this one of the things that makes this intangible asset more difficult to hold, retain, and value?
Well, I said earlier that these intangible assets behave differently from an economic point of view. And in the book, we have a framework. We say that there are four S's, four things that begin with S that determine how they're different. And one of those S's, the first of those S's, is that intangible assets tend to be highly scalable. What that means is if you own a valuable intangible, like, say, Uber's algorithms, you can scale that across a large business without a lot of need for reinvestment. Now, if you think of back to the world of tangible assets, let's suppose you own a traditional taxi cab company. Mm-hmm. If your business doubles, you need to buy twice as many taxi cabs to satisfy that business. You need to invest more in the tangible assets to deal with the business. If you're Uber and your business doubles, you don't need to develop a new algorithm. Sure, you might need to patch it a little bit, but fundamentally the algorithm will scale across a very large business without much more acquisition. Now, that is a huge advantage for leading firms in these businesses. If they have valuable intangibles, those will go a long way.
And you point out also that Google, for example, is one of those companies that starts out in one way and then is able to mirror or model what others are doing, say in the case of the iPhone and the Android. Explain what that transferability of the technology that others build and yet others are able to capitalize on, what that means in this new capital society without capital.
So the second of our S's, of our economic properties of intangibles, is spillovers. And I guess what that means is if you're a company, if you are, say, Apple, and you invest in a valuable intangible, you invest in, say, the design of the new iPhone back in 2007, radical design of a smartphone, like no other smartphone before, and it made, obviously, a huge impact. Or the software, the iOS software that went into the first, the operating system that went into the first iPhone. You may very well get the benefit from that, but other firms can often get the benefit from those investments as well. And indeed, in smartphones, that's exactly what we saw. Within 18 months, almost every smartphone looked a bit like an iPhone. That design spilled over to others. And obviously, Google released Android, I think, within a year of iOS being released. And there was a kind of famous battle between Steve Jobs and Google where he accused them of copying and many worse things. Now, that, for the most part, doesn't happen with tangible assets. If you have a business and you invest in a new factory, your competitors can't use the factory. You put a security guard on the door. It's illegal to break into someone's factory.
or a dog.
If you come up with a new idea, if you come up with a new design, then it is much harder. Even with patents, even with design rights, it is harder to keep those things entirely to yourself. So they spill over.
Since you've already given us two of the differences that these various economic properties demonstrate when they are more intangible, you talked about scalability, you talked about spillovers. Let's get into the other two S's because we don't want to leave everybody dangling. Sunk costs, you say they're harder to sell or recover their value. Explain that.
So if you have many tangible assets, if you own a business, say you own an airline and you own a bunch of airlines or leases, airplanes and a bunch of leases on planes, if, God forbid, your business goes bankrupt, those planes are very fungible. They can be, creditors can take them over. They can recover a lot of the value of the loan they made. These things are not sunk. They can be traded off. But intangibles are very often sunk. If your business fails, intangibles like design, like operating procedures, like brands are often worth much less or even nothing to someone else. So if, for example, a really good example, you'll remember back before the iPhone, before 2007, the biggest mobile phone manufacturer, the biggest cell phone manufacturer in the world was Nokia from Finland.
Yes.
And, 70% of phones were Nokias. The world was a very different place back in the early 2000s. Nokia got into all sorts of trouble, and when they exited, for the most part, their mobile phone business, their cell phone business, they had a bunch of tangible assets and a bunch of intangible assets. Now, one of the most valuable tangible assets was their enormous office buildings in Helsinki in Finland, and those were really fungible. They sold them off very quickly, and you can go to Helsinki, and it's full of other companies now. They recovered a lot of the value on those businesses. But they also own software, the software that went into smartphones, their equivalent of iOS, which is called Symbian. And that, they were able to recover almost nothing. No one really wanted this asset. It didn't fit into anyone else's ecosystem. So this asset, which was incredibly valuable to them at the time, was the cornerstone of their cell phone business in the way that iOS or Android are valuable to Apple or Google. This was worth very much less. And it's the same with the brands of distressed firms, with the operating procedures of distressed firms, with the supply chains. They very rapidly degrade. And that has pretty big implications for a lot of aspects of finance.
It's fascinating that you say that, because I've noticed some companies being taken over by companies that we thought were long dead but had tangible assets in the past. And some of these are food products, like Cott has just bought a plant here in the state from which we broadcast or podcast. And then another, which is Postum, which I hadn't seen for years and years and years. And my sister asked me about it, and I went up on Amazon, and somebody, lo and behold, bought the name and is now manufacturing Postum. It just seems like some of these things that were once tangible can reemerge in our culture. What happens in the intangible world? Do they ever come back in some other form?
Those examples of consumer brands coming back from the dead, as it were, is a really good example of the growing importance of intangibles in today's economy. Once upon a time, if you had, say, a food company, your tangible assets, a factory where you made the food, perhaps your farms, if that was the kind of business, would probably be a very significant part of the value. The brand might be much more minor. You'd invest much less in it. You'd advertise less and so forth. But if we look now, many of these, the tangible assets, the production, are much more of a commodity. Production prices have just fallen very significantly in the past few decades. But the brands still have value. They still have consumer appeal. And so what you're seeing, these firms that will buy the brand and resuscitate it, adding maybe some of these commodity processing factors, bringing together a bunch of brands, reviving the marketing, these guys are classic intangible operators, even if the end product, the cereal, is clearly something that you can touch and feel and even eat. I think this is a real sign of where things are going.
That makes a lot of sense. So you talked about scalability, sunk costs, spillovers. What about synergies? And maybe you can do it in the context of the example of the EpiPen.
So our fourth S, our fourth characteristic of intangibles, is synergies. And what we mean there is that intangible assets, ideas, relationships, supply chains are especially valuable when you bring them together. Ideas really are good when you put them with other ideas. And one example that really brings this home to me is the EpiPen. And your listeners will no doubt be familiar with EpiPens, particularly if you suffer or if a loved one suffers from anaphylaxis, from allergic reaction. These are the amazing medical devices that provide an easy shot of epinephrine, which will make you recover from an anaphylactic shock that could otherwise be fatal. Now, the EpiPen, as well as being a kind of medical wonder, is an extremely valuable commercial property for its owners, Mylan. In 2015, it made $1.5 billion for its owners. Now, no doubt, it's even more valuable. And we asked ourselves, why is this so valuable? Why is this product so valuable? And we think this comes down to the way that the intangibles of this product have synergies with one another. Now, you'd think, if this is a pharmaceutical product, you'd think, well, you know, surely the value is that there's some kind of patented molecule that no one else can produce. And that's not correct, actually. The epinephrine has been off patent for nearly a century. This is kind of anyone can make the underlying liquid in an EpiPen. It turns out that they have a host of other things. They have the design of the EpiPen, which is a kind of a proprietary design that's easy to use. They have very developed what you might call supply chains. If you go to public places, there are very large sales teams, very large networks that will get EpiPens into everywhere from preschools to nursing homes to workplaces to make sure they're there, which competitors find it very hard to replicate. There are even legal rules that allow these things to be distributed in ways that don't fall foul of law on medical prescriptions, both in the US, the UK, countries have, and that in a sense is another intangible asset that provides a defensive moat. Finally, there's the brand, which, you know, if you need a product in an emergency, having a salient brand is really important. The idea of an off-brand EpiPen with a different name wouldn't inspire the trust, it wouldn't inspire the customer recognition, and it wouldn't inspire the kind of emergency response that you get. And when you combine all these things together, it creates a product that's very hard to compete with, even though in the last decade, quite a lot of people have tried to launch rival EpiPens. But the reason EpiPen is so valuable as a property is because all of those things come together to make it particularly hard to compete with. And that is what we mean by the synergies of intangibles.
The book that we're talking about and the concept is Capitalism Without Capital by Stian Westlake, who's with us, and his partner Jonathan Haskell. And tell me, am I correct in looking at these numbers? From the 1950s, about 85% of the value of the economy was based on tangible assets. And from 2000 on, what is that number?
So from about 2000 on, the amount of investment in intangible assets by businesses in countries like the US started to exceed intangibles. So you're sort of seeing 13% of GDP, intangible investment representing 13% of GDP. Now, if you ask the question how much of an individual company's value is explained by intangibles in the 2000s, mm-hmm. then you're talking a much higher rate. Then you're talking something like 85%.
85%.
And that's a really remarkable change from what we saw in the 1950s. And if any of your listeners are equity analysts or if they invest in the stock market, this is something that will be really familiar to them. You, once upon a time, you could tell a lot about a company's value from its balance sheet. Increasingly, and especially if we're dealing with newer economies, the balance sheet is increasingly less and less informative, and you have to use other means.
So is some of the growth that we have experienced and yet not accounted for because we've had stagnancy in many of our Western economies in the recent period, is it because we're not counting all these intangibles?
If we properly accounted for intangibles, economic growth will be slightly higher. But I have bad news for you, which is that accounting for intangibles does not close the entire economic gap between where we currently are and where we'd like to be on growth. In fact, it's a relatively small proportion that is accounted for by that. So I would love to say we had solved the problem of economic growth through measurement, but unfortunately, that would not be true. What we can say, though, is that understanding this shift to intangibles does help give some reasons for why economic growth might be lower than it's been in previous decades.
When we look at what is now included and what we don't have a difficult time making certain is counted, software is now included in the GDP. And you say that artistic originals are now counted. What does that mean? Because I think many of us thought, I mean, and you do point to the example of EMI many years ago, where 30% of their proceeds came from Beatles music, that was always counted as part of the economy, the vibrancy of it.
the sales of things like Beatles records were always included in the kind of turnover figures in that aspect of GDP. What had been missed is the fact that these things that were created, these artistic originals, were assets in the same way that machines were assets, in that they were durable and they created value. So if I give an example, as you can tell from my accent, I'm British, and if I think about the most famous British invention of recent years, that is surely Harry Potter and the kind of whole world of Harry Potter books and movies. If we sort of say, well, what is an investment? An investment is something that a company or a firm puts time and money into building up and then delivers a benefit over a period of time, durable and delivers a benefit. The Harry Potter scripts, the Harry Potter brand, are a great example of something like that. There was an upfront period of investment. J.K. Rowling wrote the books. She was paid an advance by her publishers to write the books. And that then created a property which in all sorts of ways generated a flow of values to a bunch of companies that had rights to it, the publisher, to J.K. Rowling herself, to the filmmakers. From an economic point of view, if we're thinking how does the economy work, those are every bit as much assets as a machine sitting in a factory or a fleet of jetliners on the balance sheet of an airplane. And the core of the book is that these kind of assets are getting more and more important.
Well, you remind us that since 2013, there's been more investment in intangible capital than tangible. So even though we're still buying a lot of stuff, washing machines and dryers and so forth, that really when you look at this intangible piece of our lives, best reflected in a lot of our technology and entertainment, that this is now superseding these other hard goods.
I think that's true. The one thing I would add is that this is not just a tech sector phenomenon or a media phenomenon. That we see these intangible investments being important in all sorts of sectors, often sectors that you associate with physical things like manufacturing. Let me give an example. In the book, we talk about the business of gyms, of running gyms, which in some senses is a super, super physical business. They're places where people go and lift things to make their muscles bigger. If you look at how a gym would work 40 years ago, from a financial point of view, gyms mostly had physical assets. They had a building, they had some weights, some machines, and not a great deal else. If you look at gyms today, first of all, even though these businesses look very physical, they look quite similar, they still have machines, they still have buildings, they have a lot more software. Typically, gyms are corporate, they're much more branded. A lot of effort goes into sales and marketing in a way that didn't in 1978, not least because the way to make money in the gym business is to get people to sign up and then not go to your gym. That's how to run a profitable gym.
By February, they're empty, yeah.
And, well, exactly. And then the thing that's particularly interesting, if any of your listeners frequent gyms a lot, they will know of classes like body pump, high-intensity interval training classes. And body pump is a really fascinating example of how the economy has got intangible. So many gyms will run these body pump classes where you do kind of rapid lifting of weights and cardiovascular exercise to music with an instructor. Now, body pump is an entirely intangible business. It's run by a company in New Zealand called Les Mills International. They are a bunch of guys who sit in an office in New Zealand. They record music videos. They design exercise routines, and they sell them originally on CDs, and now they sort of just send an email around the world to all the gyms that subscribe, teaching them the routine. There are new routines every month. Hugely profitable business. Incredibly valuable, no tangible assets at all, except probably for some small building in New Zealand and a machine for a studio to practice the routines in. If you want to know how valuable they are, if you go onto Google and if you Google about my body pump class has been cancelled, you will see a whole list of petitions from around the world of people who are angry at their gym for threatening to cancel their body pump class. And it just shows you what an incredibly valuable and kind of addictive product it is. And that's a sign of intangibles getting into even a business that we think of as purely physical.
Very well illustrated. Let me ask you a couple of things. You tell us that those who are running a lot of these companies that focus on these intangibles have to be the best of the best. I mean, they really have to be so skilled in taking something that is intangible and giving it great value. But you also say at the same time that this growth of intangibles is increasing the leader-laggard gap. Explain both of these, because I think they go in tandem.
The leader-laggard gap is a really interesting economic phenomenon, and lots of other people have very acutely described this using a lot of data. And what it basically is that you look around the world, in the US and in other countries, in industry after industry, there is a growing gap between the most profitable and productive businesses and the rest. And typically in sector after sector, whether high-tech sector or low-tech sector, we see a small number of businesses that are pulling away. And it's very clear in the stats, it's been happening for about 20 or 30 years, the best businesses are rapidly outperforming the worst. I mean, there have always been bad and good companies, but it's that gap that is getting wider. As I say, this is not our original finding. It's something a lot of people have noticed. And a lot of people say, what's going on? Why could this be? You know, is it that technology is not diffusing fast enough? Is it that the government regulators who are meant to keep markets competitive are snoozing on the job? What's going on? We think there's an explanation here from these intangibles because, as I said earlier, these intangibles are getting more and more important in all industries. And these intangibles are scalable, which if you have one, you can rapidly spread it across a large business. And they have synergies, which is they're really good when you combine them. And what that suggests to me is a bit of a Matthew effect to those that have more shall be given. So those firms, like you mentioned Google before, but there are equivalents in manufacturing and services industries, those firms that have some of these valuable assets are in a position, firstly, to invest in more because of those synergies, and secondly, to grow their business rapidly because of that scalability. And that would explain this phenomenon that we're seeing of the best businesses kind of pulling away from the crowd.
You also tell us that because a lot of these things are not as easily defined or you can't hold it in your hand, that many more of these assets are contested in terms of copyright and the like. And you really begin to wonder, and you certainly pose the question, is this going to flatten or diminish the amount of investment in some of these things because you cannot protect it?
That's absolutely right. One thing that we know is that if it's hard to decide who owns a particular asset, whether that's a physical asset or an intangible asset, generally people invest less in them. If you can't be sure that you'll get the benefit of something, all other things being equal, why invest? And we certainly see this if we look at some high-tech areas where, say, in the music industry, a lot of the music rights holders, a lot of the music production companies were extremely worried at the time when internet piracy first took off, with Napster back in the late 90s, were worried that if it became harder to assert rights to own some of these intangibles, and a piece of music is a great example of an intangible asset, the incentive to invest will go away. And I think what that means is that these issues like how do we deal with copyrights? How do we deal with patents? How do we prevent patent trolling, but at the same time have appropriately enforceable patents in appropriate areas? All of these things will be really important. And the nations that work out the right legal fixes to this, the right institutions to make these things work, those will be the ones that will prosper in the intangible economy.
Well, Stian Westlake, I can't thank you enough for being with us today to talk about capitalism without capital. And by the way, the book really demands a read. And he and his partner talk about how cities will become more important in this process. The question of public investment really is something that will have to be tackled in this new, more intangible economy. So much more to learn, but we wanted to have you here to really outline it for us. And you did a wonderful job. Thank you so much for coming by today on America Trends.
Thank you so much.